Hello and welcome back to New Books in History, the channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zeb Larson. And today we're joined by Professor Sarah Snyder of American University to discuss her book, From Selma to Moscow, A Human Rights Activist Transformed Foreign Policy, published by Columbia University Press in 2018. The book fills an underexamined gap in the historiography of human rights by analyzing how human rights came to be an important concern of U.S. foreign policy by 1976. Snyder argues that transnational connections between American and foreign actors helped to catalyze American interest in human rights. Snyder draws on five different geographical case studies and the work done by congressmen to make clear this transformation, and drew on both traditional diplomatic archival resources as well as the papers of several different congressmen.
Dr. Snyder, welcome to the New Books Network. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you went to school, and how you came to write this book.
Well, right now I teach at American University's School of International Service in Washington, D.C. And so I'm returning to Washington, where I got my PhD at Georgetown in the history department.
Okay. Who did you work with at Georgetown?
So at Georgetown, Nancy Bernhoff Tucker was my primary supervisor, but I also worked very closely with David Painter and Michael Kazin. They were on my dissertation committee. My dissertation was on the influence of the Helsinki process that came out of the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe on U.S.-Soviet relations in the late Cold War. And then I revised that into my first book, Human Rights Activism and the End of the Cold War, A Transnational History of the Helsinki Network.
Now, just briefly, maybe for the listeners, if you could tell us a little bit about that first book. What were your conclusions?
Of course. My conclusions were that much to the surprise of pretty much everyone who participated in the initial negotiations that produced the 1975 Helsinki Final Act, that this agreement had spurred a wave of human rights activism on both sides of the Iron Curtain, and that this activism contributed to the peaceful end to the Cold War in Europe.
Okay. My next question then, how did it help? I mean, and I think it's in some ways obvious, but how did it help lead into this book?
Well, it led into this book in that I was interested in how the U.S. government formulated its foreign policy regarding human rights, and I was interested in how actors outside of the U.S. government who hope that the United States will pay more attention to human rights are able to advance and achieve that policy agenda. So I would say that the sort of the common thread between the two books is how can non-state actors who care about human rights shape U.S. foreign policy? But the second book did not necessarily come out of the research agenda of the first book, but rather when I was finishing the first book, someone asked me if I would like to present at a conference talking about sort of issues in the Lyndon Johnson administration that were not connected to the war in Vietnam. So sort of an attempt to go beyond just thinking about Johnson's foreign policy record through the prism of Vietnam. And I said, you know, I don't actually have any material on that, but I'm quite interested in that question. And so the research that I did essentially to write the conference paper that I was invited to give then led to the book project. And part of that was because I was teaching a course on the history of the United States and international human rights. And I felt like there was a real gap in the literature, essentially in between the Bricker Amendment controversy in the Eisenhower administration and greater attention to human rights with the Carter administration. And so it was both kind of driven by a recognition that there wasn't enough out there for teaching and this invitation. So that's how I got started on this second project.
Fascinating. Now, before we dive into From Selma to Moscow, I'm just curious, what did the archival research look like for this project?
It was varied. It required a lot of financial support and a lot of travel. Certainly, you know, I did research in some of the places that we would absolutely expect a diplomatic historian would be doing research. The National Archives here in the Washington area, going through State Department records. I also visited the Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford presidential libraries. But I probably traveled to, I don't know, at least eight collections of congressional papers. So, for example, I went to Minnesota to go through Donald Frazier's papers, and I went to Boise, Idaho to go through Frank Church's papers. I also worked in the archives of a number of key human rights organizations like Amnesty International. And then I also did research in the British as well as Chilean archive, looking through their records relating to their foreign policy.
Wonderful. So having set up the book a little bit, let's talk about it. From Selma to Moscow, how is this book structured?
So the book is structured around, there's six main chapters to the book. Five of them are geographically focused on the Soviet Union, Southern Rhodesia, South Korea, Chile, and Greece. And then the final chapter looks at congressional hearings held in the early 1970s, and both the sort of genesis of those hearings and then what I see as their lasting accomplishments in terms of legislation that was produced by the hearings.
And I'm curious, so those five geographical chapters, they were all very interesting. And I'm curious, what drew you specifically to them? Did you think that they were the most resonant issues for human rights actors at the time, or were they sort of the more significant ones in hindsight? What about those drew you?
So I started off collecting, say, when I went to the Johnson Library or when I was in Amnesty International's records, collecting on a wide range of countries, some of which, say, I knew to have poor human rights records. You know, a country like China or a country like Iran, I was interested in how much American actors were concerned about the human rights mm-hmm. violations in those places. And what I decided in the end, I think that I could have certainly had more cases, but I thought that these five cases were the countries that were of most concern to the American actors that I was looking at. The only exception to that, I would say, would be South Africa, which I didn't include because I thought there had already been so much good literature on sort of American activism regarding apartheid in South Africa. But beyond South Africa, I really, I went with the cases that inspired the most congressional, diplomatic, and non-governmental activism.
Interesting. And before I want to, and I want to start diving into these case studies so listeners can appreciate sort of these interesting and disparate circumstances that bring people together. Do you have any sense what makes a human rights issue sort of catch public interest in the United States? You know, I think it was Adam Hochschild who said that human rights issues are fickle. The Belgian Congo caught people at the beginning of the 20th century, but the French Congo, which had similar issues, never resonated the same way. Do you have a sense of what factors sort of drive interest, at least in the United States in this period?
Well, one of the things that I argue in the book is that Americans in this period were, in my view, drawn to human rights activism through transnational connections. So just to give you one example, thinking about the chapter that focuses on Greece, in the wake of the 1967 coup in Greece, many Americans, particularly economists, mobilized to try and save the most prominent political prisoner at the time, Andreas Papandreou, who they worried that the Greek government was going to execute. Because he was seen as a threat to the military junta in power. And the reason, and Andreas, before going into Greek politics, had been trained and worked as an economist in the United States in a number of institutions on the East Coast, in Minnesota, in California. And he had a very wide network of economists who were sending telegrams to the White House, who traveled to Greece to try and have his conditions of imprisonment improved, to try and secure his release from the Greek government. And so in the book, I call him an identifiable political prisoner because he was well known to many influential Americans, and this motivated their activism in response to the coup in Greece.
Okay. So let's dive now into the specific chapter. Let's start with chapter one. What is chapter one about?
So chapter one is about the ways in which Americans respond to a range of human rights violations in the Soviet Union. We often think about Americans being active regarding the push for Soviet Jews to be able to emigrate, in particular, to be able to emigrate and move to Israel. But there were also a number of other human rights issues, say freedom of expression, that motivated Americans. And so there were, I would say, a range of groups who were concerned throughout the period that the book looks at, which is really sort of 1961 up until 1976, and who expressed their concern in a range of ways. There were large-scale demonstrations on the Mall in Washington, at Madison Square Garden, out in front of the Soviet consulate in New York City, as well as letter-writing campaigns, op-eds. And so this was a cause that inspired many Americans to speak out about what they saw as human rights violations in the Soviet Union.
And what time period are we talking about here? Just so we have nice specific dates for listeners.
Well, I would say that, the book covers the Kennedy administration through the Ford administration. But in terms of activism surrounding the plight of Soviet citizens, I would say that it really picks up in the mid to late 1960s. That's when you start to have organizations that are specifically devoted, say, to the struggle of Soviet Jewry. That's the time when you start to have more significant public demonstrations. And so it's really something that picks up, I would say, sort of in the years between 1965 and 1967.
Okay. That's getting close to, it hasn't quite yet begun, the era of detente. So does the issue of right for Soviet Jewry or freedom of expression have an impact on the Nixon administration as it tries to move towards a new kind of relationship with the Soviet Union?
Well, one thing that I found in my research was that, I think we're aware of the ways in which the Nixon administration was cautious about championing human rights based on a fear that this could damage other items on their diplomatic agenda. And this was the case with the Soviet Union as well as other countries. But I was interested to see how much the Johnson administration had a very similar position in terms of not wanting to criticize the Soviet Union, say, publicly in a UN forum. And I think that we often overlook how much the Johnson administration was interested in pursuing detente with the Soviet Union. You know, for a number of reasons, it didn't come to fruition as much as he might have hoped. But just as, say, Johnson was potentially willing to overlook the invasion of Prague in 1968 in order to have the summit meeting that he wanted, the Johnson administration was also willing to overlook human rights violations in the Soviet Union in order to improve their relationship with that country.
So moving on to chapter two, what is chapter two about?
Chapter two is about the ways in which Americans responded to the unilateral declaration of independence by Ian Smith's white minority regime in Southern Rhodesia in 1965.
Okay, so which actors are we looking on the American side? Are we looking at in this particular case study? Who are the responsible players?
One of the most active Americans in this period regarding Southern Rhodesia was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Arthur Goldberg, who repeatedly spoke out at the UN through op-eds in letters to Johnson and said, essentially, we can't have two policies regarding racial discrimination. We cannot say that all Americans should have full access to their rights, but that Black Southern Rhodesians don't deserve the same sort of full achievement of their rights. And so again and again, he said that we can't have a double standard, essentially. And there were a number of other people who were active in the civil rights movement in the United States who were trying to put pressure on the U.S. government to be sort of more aggressive in trying to deny the staying power of Ian Smith and his regime. And in particular, in terms of organizations, I would say that the American Committee on Africa did things like mobilize dock workers to refuse to unload ships that were coming in from Southern Rhodesia and to have demonstrations to signal their displeasure with Ian Smith's regime.
Now, you bring this up for this chapter on Rhodesia, but also the chapter on South Korea, that there's a strong involvement of church groups within this. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I would say that the involvement of church groups in my reading is mostly tied to missionaries who are serving in these countries and who develop close personal relationships with people whose human rights are abused, which lead them then to become not just sort of religious actors in their communities, but human rights actors in their communities. And in the case of South Korea, there's an American missionary who is arrested and then expelled from the country because he was speaking out about human rights violations there. And so these missionaries, sort of through traditional communication networks and through visits of their co-religionists, make broader religious communities within the United States aware of what's happening. And so I think that's really what's driving the involvement of these religious communities within the U.S. is that they have missionaries that they're supporting who are reporting back to them about these issues.
It's interesting. To rewind just a little bit back to Rhodesia, do you get a sense that the same missionaries who are involved in what will become sort of Rhodesian activism in the United States, are they also civil rights actors? Is there an overlap there?
Based on my reading of their sort of reminiscences, they were influenced to seek a missionary posting in Africa by what was happening domestically in the United States regarding the civil rights movement. But I wouldn't say that they were people who were professionally involved, say, in the civil rights movement and then shifted to becoming a missionary, but rather that as they were, say, getting their education and being trained as a missionary, they were sensitive to and interested in what was happening, and that motivated their request for a certain placement. So I would say it's the context in which they are beginning their missionary careers.
That's interesting. And bringing up the civil rights point is interesting, too. Everybody is sort of operating in this civil rights context. Do you think that's sort of driving this turn to interest in global human rights in this period? Can it be separated at all?
I think that certainly everyone is operating in this context. It seems to influence some people in different ways. And I think that may be about, for example, in the chapter on Chile, I talk about someone who was sent there as a missionary, and he talks very much about his experience of growing up in a segregated community and participating in protests against segregation. And so I think that for many people, the civil rights movement directly impacted their human rights activism. But I think that there are others for whom, say, some of these economists that I'm talking about, they're really driven by their personal connections to the human rights abuses, as opposed to, I think maybe the civil rights movement might have primed them a little bit, but I think they're fundamentally focused on the fact that, you know, their good friend is in prison. So I think, one of the key things is that Americans were motivated by different factors in this period, and certainly the civil rights movement was one of the most significant, but I wouldn't say that it was sort of evenly significant for all of the actors that I look at.
And one last question on Rhodesia, and then I want to move on. What does this do? I mean, in this particular case, the U.S. government doesn't recognize that the Rhodesian government exists legally, but nevertheless, it has a kind of relationship with that government. What effect does it have to have somebody like Arthur Goldberg at the UN speaking out against Rhodesia on top of this sort of non-state citizen activism that's going on in the background?
Well, certainly the Johnson administration hoped that the stance that they did take and Goldberg's repeated statements would have both an external and an internal audience. The Johnson administration was working very hard to try and convince American leaders within the civil rights movement that it cared about these issues. And there was also an audience, not just of African leaders, but also of their allies, say in the UN, newly independent Asian leaders. And the Johnson administration wanted to signal that it was sort of on the right side of these questions of decolonization and race.
And is there a shift when it comes over to Nixon? There's that famous memorandum, I think it was NSC 39, which he states, or the authors state, that the preferred option is to try to have some kind of accommodation with the white minority regimes because, in their words, they're not going anywhere. It's better to work with them than just cast them out into the wind.
Yes, there is a shift from the Johnson administration to the Nixon administration. Initially, the Nixon administration tried to keep quiet how much of a shift it was contemplating undertaking, because it knew that there would be considerable congressional opposition to a shift. But the Nixon administration made very different calculations in terms of some of these issues.
So let's move now. South Korea is an interesting one, especially in contrast to Chapter 2. Again, Rhodesia doesn't exist as it cannot be, in a sense, a U.S. ally, at least in any sort of open sense. South Korea, on the other hand, is an open American ally. So what are the issues that some Americans are seeing with South Korea, and how does that play out?
Well, the principal issue is that the leadership in South Korea, it becomes increasingly dictatorial. There are repeated impositions of martial law. There are the passage of emergency decrees that make things like not attending your classes at university a sort of a punishable offense. And any opposition, political opposition, is targeted and treated quite harshly. And this is at a time in which the United States is offering considerable military assistance to South Korea. And there's a considerable presence of U.S. personnel in the country, both of which are seen by critics of the South Korean government as propping up this dictatorial leader and enabling him to stay in power. So essentially, there's a concern that the United States is complicit in his human rights abuses through its funding and its personnel.
Now, where is the direction of the criticism coming from in this chapter? In the last chapter, at least some of it was coming from within the U.S. government, Goldberg. Are there voices at state? Are there non-citizen actors? Who's doing the talking here?
So I would say that with regard to South Korea, you have a few constituencies who are critical of this. You have missionaries. There's a considerable missionary presence. And as I mentioned, there was a U.S. missionary stationed in South Korea who was arrested and expelled from the country. And that arrest, I would say, only inspired more criticism among missionaries about what the South Korean government was doing. There was also, within the diplomatic corps of the United States that were stationed in Seoul, there were a number of critics, people who were in regular touch with opposition politicians or labor activists or journalists who were aware of and trying to improve the conditions that those people faced. And then within the U.S. government in Washington, there were members of Congress who were quite critical of the South Korean government and of continued high levels of U.S. security assistance to that government.
Just to
interject, there were not significant non-governmental organizations, either of people of Korean descent or of people who cared about what was happening in South Korea. In other cases, you had organizations that popped up that were very focused on, say, in the case of Southern Rhodesia, the American Committee on Africa was quite active. But there were not, at least I did not come across, any sort of significant organizations that were working on the South Korean case. There were a few academics who knew the country well, who would often testify before Congress, but there wasn't a kind of lobbying organization that was focused on South Korean issues.
And I know it's difficult to prove why something didn't exist, but do you have any sense for why that maybe didn't come into being in this case?
Well, in the book, I suggest a few reasons. I think one of them may be tied to U.S. immigration practices, and that until 1965, you don't have significant immigration to the United States from the Korean Peninsula. I also think that that many Americans' sort of experience of Korea was through the war in Korea and fighting against the Chinese and the North Koreans. And I think that because of that experience, a number of Americans were willing to perhaps be more flexible with their appraisal of the South Korean government because in their view, the leadership there sort of faced this larger existential threat from communism in the North. And they were therefore a bit more willing to accept human rights violations for this sort of broader cause tied to Cold War priorities.
And what is the response of the at least the executive branch to this sort of these criticisms that are coming from within the government and then this sort of small community of academics too?
Well, I would say sort of looking at internal records that executive branch officials do not think that the steps that the South Korean government is taking are warranted by the security concerns, but they are not willing to, or they don't think it's worth it to sort of openly challenge these practices. And some of that is tied to, I think, sort of loyalty to a key American ally, but also that the United States, say, thinking about the Johnson administration, is distracted by the war in Vietnam and isn't necessarily going to challenge the South Korean government, which was contributing to the effort in Vietnam when it was so occupied with what was happening elsewhere in Asia. So I think some of it is about sort of the allied relationship, but I think also for some of these leaders, the problems in South Korea don't rise sort of to the top of the agenda.
Hmm. And that your last point about the war in Vietnam got me thinking on this point. What's the role of the war in Vietnam on this issue, but maybe even more broadly on activism in this period? I mean, you note in the chapter that there are parallels between support for the South Vietnamese government, the South Korean government. What effect do you see that have play out?
So for me, the most significant effect of the war in Vietnam is a kind of broad crumbling of the Cold War consensus, both that containment is always the best foreign policy to be pursuing, but also of a kind of unquestioning support for U.S. leadership in terms of foreign policy. And so as members of Congress and people outside of the government increasingly question what the United States is doing in Vietnam, I think they're increasingly willing to question U.S. policy in other areas of the world as well. I see that as the most significant element. There are sort of other ways in which it pops up, but that is the kind of broad brushstroke, just like we were talking earlier about the ways in which the context of the civil rights movement is so key, the context of opposing the war in Vietnam is sort of at the heart of the worldview of many of these human rights activists.
So let's move on to Greece, which we've already alluded to a bit. There are a few, I really enjoyed this chapter in part because it had such a personal dimension to it. So why don't you go into that a little
bit? Yeah, so in addition to the economists that I talked about earlier, who are motivated because they know Andreas Papandreou, there's also a man, James Beckett, who marries a Greek woman, Maria, that he meets while he's traveling around the country with his family in the late 1950s. And he moves with her to Geneva, where they hear the news about the 67 coup and all of the repression that followed, the political imprisonments, putting people in island concentration camps, the use of torture. And he sets out to make people in Europe and the United States aware of what's happening and to try and affect the way the junta is conducting itself in Greece. And one of the meetings that he is able to set up is with the head of Amnesty International, Sean McBride. And McBride suggests that that they undertake a kind of fact-finding mission to Greece. And the outcome of this is that Beckett is a co-author of Amnesty International's report on torture in Greece that really raised international attention to what was happening in that country. And so he is, you know, because of this personal relationship, as well as he would say other kind of contextual factors, led him to become incredibly involved in highlighting what was happening and trying to change the practices of the Greek government. I came to learn about him because, as I, you know, I was saying earlier, I went to Boise, Idaho, and I went to Minnesota, and I went to all of these different congressional collections. And in all of them, I found letters from Elise Beckett in Lakeville, Connecticut. And she was writing to sort of, it seemed like everyone, you know, not her own representatives, but she was writing to all of these people about the problems regarding human rights in Greece. And I just had this question in my notes for years, you know, why does Elise Beckett in Lakeville, Connecticut care about human rights? And over time, I came to realize it was because her son, James Beckett, cared about what was happening in Greece. And so she really became this sort of one woman show, whether it was extensive correspondence to members of Congress or her son, James, told me that she went to Capitol Hill here in Washington and would roller skate around the halls of Congress so that she could more efficiently lobby members of Congress regarding cutting off assistance to Greece.
That's interesting. What's the relationship of the U.S. government to the Greek coup plotters, and does that change over time?
I mean, I would say that both the Johnson and Nixon administrations have a complicated relationship with the coup plotters, in that they are a NATO ally that they see as really key to kind of defending the Eastern Mediterranean from the Soviet Union. And I was interested to discover how much the kind of example of de Gaulle pulling France out of NATO struck fear in U.S. officials that essentially they couldn't push Greece too far because Greece might pull out of NATO as well. But at the same time, a number of officials are uncomfortable with both with the idea that Greece, sort of this, you know, cradle of democracy, has had a military coup, but also with the idea that it's American tanks that are on the streets in Athens repressing Greek students, say, who are demonstrating. And so even in the Nixon administration, which we think of as being sort of generally less supportive of human rights as a priority, you have U.S. officials in Athens who are repeatedly saying, okay, so when are the elections going to be? Or when is there going to be a return to democracy? Some of which I think is about the optics of U.S. security assistance to Greece, but I think some of which is about a sort of general predisposition among American officials to support democracy as a form of government. And so I think that U.S. officials were frustrated in the case of Greece that they weren't able to have a greater impact there.
It's striking. I mean, you mentioned optics and that symbolism about Greece, cradle of democracy, what it means. Each of these case studies also, to me, has a certain sort of interesting optic that goes with it. With Rhodesia, you draw so heavily on civil rights. And in South Korea, of course, you have this sort of looming conflict or ongoing conflict in Vietnam. To what extent do you think these optics sort of drive these human rights issues?
Well, I mean, I guess the question there is how much you see optics as being sort of representative of something else, or if that's just the end, essentially that the U.S. doesn't want to look bad, versus I would say most of the actors that I'm looking at would say that they are motivated by what they see as the disconnect between American values and ideals and foreign policy in terms of of these human rights violations. So for them, it's not that it necessarily just that it looks bad, say, to an external audience, but that it feels bad to them, that they think that it's kind of corroding the United States to be supporting repressive governments.
It's almost a two-tiered optics. For governmental actors, they're afraid, yeah, that they're going to look bad because of it, or that this will put the United States in a negative light, whereas for somebody else, they see this connected to a broader problem, race or war, or in this case, democracy, and its fragility.
Yeah, and I think it's about their sort of in their sense of their own identity as an American. What does it mean to be an American? And for many of them, I think it means to support democratic governments and the rights of human beings. And so when they see that their government is not doing that as fully as they would like, I think it really gets it raises serious questions about their own identity as an American.
Fascinating. That's an interesting thread I could pull on all day, but we are limited for time. So let's keep moving. The fifth chapter, Chile. What happens in Chile?
So, certainly a lot has been written about the extent to which the United States actively sought to destabilize the Allende government from 1970 to 1973. But what I'm interested in the chapter is how Americans respond to the human rights violations that occur in the wake of the coup. So the chapter essentially begins with the coup in September of 1973, and then goes forward through the end of the Ford administration, looking at primarily at efforts to cut off military assistance to the government in Chile, but also in the Senate, Ted Kennedy leads an effort to try and enable more Chilean refugees to enter the United States. So there's sort of two prongs of what American activists are concerned about. You know, they want absolutely to stop all security assistance, but they also want to offer sort of sanctuary to Chileans who need to leave the country because their lives and well-being are at risk.
Now, we know now that the U.S. government was at the very least complicit in the coup and assisted in trying to destabilize Allende. How well was this understood by American human rights actors at the time, though?
I mean, I would say that many of the actors that I look at believed that the United States was complicit in destabilizing Allende, and that there were news reports that they saw as confirming this belief. And as we move forward in time, then there are hearings about CIA oversight that confirm some of the actions that had been sort of alleged and reported on, but maybe not confirmed through official channels. So I would say that this sense that the United States was responsible pervades this period, even if there wasn't, kind of the declassified cables that we can look at now and point to. But there was a sense that not just the U.S. government, but also the U.S. corporations were complicit in what was happening there.
Now, that's really interesting, and this was something I wanted to touch on. Chile, and you say this in the book, I think, that it's the only of the case studies you looked at where there was an economic component to human rights. Generally, in these other cases, it stayed to political, civic, those rights, maybe social. Do you have any sense why economics sort of became part of the discussion here? What makes it different from the others?
Well, I think that I think it's based on the national actors, essentially the Chileans, and sympathizers with them, are being repressed in part because of their support for Allende's political, economic, and social policies. And I think that I think sometimes the picture that we have of, say, U.S.-based activists doesn't fully take account of how much they are influenced by actors in or people who have fled from the countries that they're concerned with. And so I think it's really the sort of discourse was shaped a lot by both Chileans and sort of people at the very far left end of the political spectrum in the United States who were sympathetic with what Allende had been trying to do.
It is in the position of at least its accusers can say that it is much more immediately complicit in what's going on in Chile in this period. What are the responses you're seeing coming out of the Nixon administration?
The Nixon administration wants to stifle all criticism of Pinochet and the military. They want to stifle criticism within the State Department. They want to stifle criticism of journalists. They want to stifle criticism of refugees. And they are very concerned with the optics. And some of the sort of great documents that have been declassified in connection with this case show Kissinger essentially telling Pinochet to just hurry up. So there is not pressure to change human rights practices, but to potentially change the timing and pace of them so that the Chilean government can, say, face less criticism at the UN or face less criticism within the Congress. But it's not really about the substance of what the Chilean military is doing, but more how it's being reported on and perceived elsewhere in the world.
You touched on an interesting tension that I perceived in the book, which seems to be between lower echelons within the State Department and Kissinger, especially, though really, I mean, the higher ups within the executive branch sort of fall within this too. In many cases, officials in the State Department at least betray some kind of uneasiness or discomfort with what's going on in these various geographical locations. Do you think that there was a long-term shift that happens within the State Department during this period, or is it fairly consistent?
I mean, there's certainly significant institutional changes within the State Department, in that State Department officials are increasingly tasked with monitoring human rights issues in the countries in which they're stationed or in the countries that they cover from Washington, and that there are people who are writing, you know, by the end of the book, there are people who are writing these annual country reports about the human rights records of countries that are receiving assistance from the United States. But the reputation was that human rights was a kind of dead-end thing to get into. I didn't find that to be as true as I thought it would be when I was looking through, for example, transcripts of oral history interviews. I didn't see as much resistance to the idea that the United States should pay attention to human rights as I have been led to believe might be the case. And so I, you know, it's possible that we could say that that's about an institutional shift. I think it's also possible that we were misreading sort of the lack of State Department personnel's interest in human rights. I think perhaps in part because what I found in my research is that people who are stationed in these countries were far more engaged in and concerned about human rights issues than those who are based in Washington. And so I think this may get to a kind of question of sources. If you only are looking at an assistant secretary, maybe you're not seeing the full picture of how much the labor attaché is upset about the fact that union organizers are being arrested.
That makes sense. So then these we've laid out the five geographical case studies. Your sixth chapter is about Congress. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So the sixth chapter is about Donald Fraser, who is the chair of the House Subcommittee on International Organizations and Movements, who in 1973 decides to hold a series of hearings about human rights. His subcommittee then issues a report that includes suggestions for how U.S. foreign policy might better take account of and influence international protection for human rights, and then which leads to a range of legislation, both that addresses sort of some of the institutionalization of attention to human rights within the State Department that I was talking about earlier, but also that influences the extent to which human rights conditions should be a factor in security assistance, economic assistance, and the voting of the United States on, say, international bodies regarding loans and other things. So I see these hearings as really essential, both to making members of Congress and the American public more aware of the issue of human rights, but that they have the greatest long-term impact in terms of U.S. foreign policy going forward.
Do you get a sense at all what motivated Fraser?
Well, this was the paper that I talked about that sort of led me to this project for this conference on Lyndon Johnson, really focused on Fraser. And that was a question that motivated my research for the whole book. I mean, I talked earlier about this question of, like, why does Elise Beckett care about human rights? And I was really interested in why Fraser cared about human rights, because he didn't necessarily seem to have a kind of constituency that was pressing him on this. It was something that he seemed to have come to on his own. And as far as I can tell from talking to him, from spending a lot of time working through his papers, it's a sort of broad kind of vision of liberal democracy in which the United States should not be, you know, he talks a lot about the impact of the coup in Greece on him, but also of the U.S. 1965 intervention in the Dominican Republic, and essentially that the U.S. military and U.S. equipment and U.S. personnel, he really thinks that the United States should not be actively involved in repressing citizens of other countries. For him, that does not fit at all with American values and ideals. And so he's someone who I think is really influenced by this sort of broad weakening of kind of unshakable belief in and support for the U.S. government in terms of its foreign policy.
So I have a question, this is one of those obnoxious two-part questions. First of all, was human rights a partisan issue in this period?
I would say that there is a greater representation of Democrats among those who are active on human rights, but it is not an issue that was only the purview of Democrats. Paul Findlay, who was a representative from Illinois, was very active on Fraser's subcommittee. And I spent some time going through his papers, and people wrote to him about a wide range of human rights issues. So I would say that there are Republicans who are supportive of the human rights agenda. And then there are also Republicans who will support the agenda because it aligns with other priorities of theirs. For example, there are a number of members of Congress who are opposed to U.S. foreign assistance across the board. And so they were willing to support efforts to cut off security or economic assistance to repressive governments because it aligned with their broader opposition to foreign assistance, which is a little bit different than, you know, are they believers in the extent to which the United States should be taking account of human rights, but it has the same effect in that they are willing to support these efforts to cut off security assistance, say, to Chile or to Greece.
Well, I think it points at least an interesting dimension to some of the sort of, I don't want to say subconscious, but the sort of underlying factors that can undergird interest in human rights is also a question of what's the proper role of the United States in the world. And that can draw in people who want to make the United States into a beacon of social liberty, and also people who kind of don't want a big role for the United
Absolutely.
States and the globe.
The other thing I would add sort of in trying to get a kind of picture of the partisan nature or not, I was quite interested in the extent to which during the Johnson administration, you have Democratic members of Congress who are opposing a Democratic president. And the internal debates within the National Security Council and the State Department about trying to avoid congressional displeasure, say, if the United States started sending more heavy military equipment to Greece, which I think highlight the extent to which it's not, say, just a partisan issue, but that there are ways to think about what's motivating these people that's not just about kind of winning in some type of political or electoral battle.
So here's the second part of that teased second part question. In 2018, bipartisanship seems so profoundly dead, it's almost difficult to imagine. Was there a closer spirit of bipartisanship that was driving some of this?
I don't think so. It's not something that I see the actors talking about as a priority, say that we need to convey a bipartisan front on this, or that we need to make sure we get Republican support for X. And so I don't see a sort of prioritization of bipartisanship as motivating, say, the tactics or strategies of some of these activists. And I guess I might also question the extent to which there is not bipartisan support for human rights today. I mean, if we think about who are some of the most prominent voices on human rights right now, I think we would have to look at John McCain and Marco Rubio, even if some Republicans might say that might be critical of human rights as a sort of democratic issue. Within the Congress, there seems to be considerable bipartisanship, at least regarding some human rights issues.
So one of the striking things to me in the case studies you outlined is that some of them, Chile, fall very much on the left in American life. But Soviet Jewry is also something that sort of exists as an issue for more conservative Americans. What it seems to say to me is that bipartisanship isn't really so much a thing as that human rights, it needs to be specified, and then depending on its specificity, it can apply to different people. But it's not a transcendent issue inherently. I wonder what you think about that.
I'm sort of pausing about this idea of it not being a transcendent issue, because I guess I would say that I think it does transcend a lot of other divides, whether they're racial or religious or political. But I think your initial point that you can get very strange political bedfellows on human rights issues is accurate. I mean, the neoconservatives, come out of a kind of Henry Jackson approach to the Cold War, which says that détente is immoral for ignoring the human rights violations of the Soviet Union and for not pressing for greater freedom of emigration for Soviet Jews. And so very much you have, I think, people who are motivated not necessarily by a kind of universal and indivisible commitment to human rights, but support for a specific type of human right or human rights in a specific place or a specific way that that bring people together who wouldn't necessarily agree on all of the other sort of items in their political agenda.
Wonderful. Now, we're just about at the end of our hour here, but I wanted to ask one last question. What are you working on now? Or if you're in between, what are you thinking about looking at next?
So I'm doing a few things right now. One thing that I've just finished is a paper about congressional activism in response to increasing repression in Uruguay in the mid-1970s. I had initially thought that I would have a chapter in the book that would look at the Southern Cone broadly, but there was so much material on Chile that I couldn't fit anything else in. So this is a sort of an outgrowth of the project, something I wasn't able to fully explore in the book. And then moving forward, what I'm working on is Americans who are active overseas. This is sort of building on my argument that transnational connections drive American human rights activism, but I'm interested in Americans who are not necessarily involved in human rights in any way. Americans who are serving abroad as teachers, as students, as business people, as artists, and trying to understand how their transnational encounters shape U.S. foreign policy.
All right. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me today, Dr. Snyder.
Thank you so much for having me.